Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each weekday we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, a short passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength and insight here in everyday life. And on Wednesdays, we talk to some of our fellow students of ancient philosophy, well-known and obscure, fascinating and powerful. With them, we discuss the strategies and habits that have helped them become who they are and also to find peace and wisdom in their actual lives. But first, we've got a quick message from one of our sponsors. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now. You never know what someone is going through. People are frustrating. They fall short. They fail us. They do something that surprises or disappoints you. But before you get angry, you have to remember, everyone is going through something. Sometimes people are going through things they don't even know about. NBA All-Star Kevin Love began suffering panic attacks several years into his career that severely affected his game. Mental health is not something that gets talked about a lot in professional sports. So for a long time, Love struggled with this private demon alone. It wasn't until he began to share his story publicly that he discovered that other players battled with all sorts of mental health issues. Before that, it didn't even occur to Love that he wasn't alone, that other players also had issues. We all do this. Our natural absorption inclines us to assume that we're the only people to have a good reason to be tired, angry, frustrated, scared, or hardened. So we rob ourselves of the empathy of others. We close ourselves off from the opportunity to become personally much more empathetic, both of which Kevin Love experienced when he started to share his struggle. Seneca reminds us that a leader should grant pardon but ask for none, that they should make excuses for other people because of what they're going through, but not themselves. Marcus Aurelius tried constantly to put himself in other people's shoes, particularly those who sniped at him or made his life more difficult. He tried to understand what made them act the way they did, because he wanted to be able to forgive them, because he wanted to be able to offer them leeway for their failings, to be able to make use of their strengths where possible. And this is all a much better alternative to walking around either beating yourself up because you're the lone loser, weakling, or head case, or assuming the worst of everyone and granting no forgiveness or tolerance for not being at your level. Remember, everyone is going through something. They might not even be aware of that, just as it took you a while to figure out what was troubling you. So cut your fellow humans some slack, grant pardon, even if they struggle to do that for you in turn. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I have been starting to fool around with the next book. I started about a week and a half ago, laying out all the note cards. I was starting to doubt myself. I was starting to get worried. I was intimidated by the project. I wasn't sure if it was going in the right direction. And then I found this note card that I'd wrote and slipped into the box. I don't know when, but I'd always been planning to work on it about now. So I wrote, "Trust the process. Keep doing your note cards. When you check this in June, if you have done your work, there will be a book there." And as it turned out, a few days ago, it clicked. All of a sudden, the three main characters I wanted to profile sort of became clear to me. How I was going to delineate became clear. And now, although there's still a very, 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 very long road ahead of me, I do have a vague map for the direction that I need to go. And I'm going to do it. So I'm chugging away on that. Going to do all my regular stuff in the meantime. And I will tell you more about it as it comes. But it's the second book in a 4-book series. I'll leave it at that, and we'll check in with that. We'll check in with that soon. My guest today, I'm very excited to talk about. We had a whole bunch of technical difficulties on this interview. I was interviewing two different people at the same time, which is always tricky. And yet we persevered. At one point, they couldn't hear each other, and then one of them got kicked out. And then I thought we lost the file, but we kept going, and here we are. I'm talking to the authors of The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives. I've loved this book. My wife loved this book. We carry it at the Painted Porch Bookstore. It's one of the few parenting books we have. It's a fantastic book. It's really about this idea of agency. How do you give your kids control over their own lives? Because believing that you have control over your own lives is essential. And we talk about, of course, the Stoics say the vast majority of what happens is not in our control, but we have to decide what we do with what is in our control. That's what we're going to talk about today. This episode's going to land hardest with those of you who have kids. But even if you don't have kids, I actually got a lot out of it as a human being. You know, there's this great idea. You're not raising kids, you're raising adults, right? How do you make adults? But then also, how do you be an adult, right? How do you be the best self that you can be? And then how do you pass this on to your kids? That's really what we're talking about. And my two guests are quite distinguished. Dr. William Stixrud, goes by Bill, is a clinical neuropsychologist and a member of the Children's National Medical Center and George Washington University Medical School. He's an expert on the human brain, particularly in adolescence, and he's published many influential scientific articles about it. And then Ned Johnson, the co-writer on the book, is the founder of Prep Matters, a tutoring service in Washington, D.C. He's the co-author of Conquering the SAT, How Parents Can Help Teens Overcome the Pressure and Succeed. Both my guests today are experts. They speak all over the world. They've written everywhere for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal. I've loved their stuff. I've loved this book. I recommend it. If you want to pick it up, you can check the links in today's episode to pick it up at The Painted Porch, or just go to thepaintedporch.com. Come see us in Bastrop, Texas. Or, of course, support the local bookstore in your town or pick it up on Amazon. It's a great book, a must-read for parents. And I think this is a great episode. And it happens that the two guys know their fair share of Stoicism. And I'll leave it at that. I thought we could start with a definition. Let's go way back to basics. So before even getting into what a self-driven child looks like, what does it mean to be self-driven? Because I feel like there's plenty of adults that don't necessarily understand it and maybe struggle with that in their own lives.
So I think that Ned and I lectured for some years together about motivation in kids. And some of the parents that I work with and that Ned work with, they're just concerned about their kids are overly motivated. They're kind of obsessively driven. Or a lot of kids that I see, Ryan, are have learning disabilities or ADHD. They just don't seem to be that motivated. And we realize what we want is for our kids to and for us to feel that kind of internal drive that this is our life and we're gonna make what we want of it. We're able to make what we want of our lives. And I think that's for me what this self-driven quality is. It's that the motivation and the direction for our life comes within us.
I'm really glad you said that because it's something I've written about before, and certainly the ancients were concerned with it. This idea of ambition isn't inherently a good thing, right? Because a lot of times very ambitious people are either ambitious for the wrong ends or they're ambitious because
they've picked this up from someone else, right? Someone wants to be a doctor because their parents wanted them to be a doctor. They want to be wealthy because they think wealth will make them happy. They feel like they need to prove something to someone or something. So it sounds like what you're saying is that drive in and of itself is not necessarily a virtue. That drive has to come from a place of sort of fullness and self-awareness and a sense of your own needs and wants, especially in kids. It can't just be you're just driven to do whatever your parents told you you should do.
Well, I used to do a lot of psychotherapy, and what I was struck by, how many 30-year-olds or 40-year-olds would come into my office and I'd say, how can I help? And they'd say, well, I feel like I've spent the first 35 years of my life trying to live up to other people's expectations. Now I'm trying to figure out what kind of life I want, what's important to me. And I thought, you know, we could get a lot earlier start on this.
Yeah, Ned, I was thinking of your work when I was watching the college admissions documentary on Netflix, and I read that book, Unacceptable, about the admissions scandal. What I found so interesting about it is it wasn't the kids who desperately necessarily wanted to get into Harvard or USC or whatever. This was being pushed upon them. In some cases, they internalized it, but it must be sort of surprising or surreal to watch where the source of the motivation that you see in young people, and how I guess a good portion of them are not self-driven at all.
Yeah, I mean, there are a bunch of things there. I mean, one, a quick word on those parents. You know, a lot of what was thrown at them, you know, particularly in the press, was that it was all, you know, it was all ego, and they need a bumper sticker on, you know, from this or that college. But it also occurred to me that and Bill and I were talking about this, that a lot of it maybe may have been driven out of fear. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a piece for the Post right around that time, saying that the message that these parents were delivering to their kids, you know, directly or indirectly, is, you know, be very afraid that you know, you can't be successful in life unless you go to an elite enough college, right? That you couldn't handle it if you didn't get in to a college, if you got rejected, that you can't do this without my help. And all of those things are terrible messages to give to kids. And to your point about motivation for kids, I mean, the problem with school, I mean, there are a bunch of problems with school, but one of the things is that the current paradigm is set up for kids to really not intrinsically care about the stuff that they're doing, but just to get an A. You know, we use the term in my test prep world of kids being station to station, and the parents will say, I don't understand, they've gotten A's in everything, but they haven't thought about it or integrated. You know, I take a test on, I learn chapter 7, take a test on it, quickly throw that over my shoulders, I move on to chapter 8. And it makes me nuts. One, because it leaves them really unprepared for any real mathematics when they get to the end of high school or go on to college. But it's also just a colossal waste of all of that adolescent time and energy, because they're just doing it to get the grade.
Yeah, there's a beautiful graphic that Tim Urban made. I just Googled Tim Urban paths graphic. And it's this cool thing of like all the things that you went through to get where you are and where you are. And then you think, like, if I don't get into college, if I don't do this, like all these paths are closed to me, but you don't right. see all the potential branches off. So you're right. The fear is like, if I don't get into Harvard, if I don't win this, if I don't accomplish this, like, the future is incredibly bleak, which is such a pessimistic view of the world to pass on to someone at 17 or 18 years old, that they don't have the ability to decide where their life is going to go if they don't make the tennis team at the University of Texas, which of course is preposterous.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. And the other point along those lines that, you know, Bill and I make when we have the opportunity to talk with schools is that even for me as a test prep guy, I mean, we hold to the belief that the most important outcome of high school and adolescence is not where you go to college, but to developing the brain that you're going to carry into the rest of your life. And so, you know, given the plasticity of adolescent brains, to be chronically stressed, to be chronically extrinsically driven, and to shape a brain that is stress intolerant, that becomes easily anxious or depressed, and that is only really responding to extrinsic motivators, I mean, that is a lousy way to launch a life, whether that's college or other paths.
Yeah, I thought of you guys also when I was reading your book, and I thought of this famous exchange. One of my sort of literary heroes is the writer Walker Percy, who wrote this great book, The Moviegoer, which is sort of about adolescent angst. And anyway, he was adopted. His parents both died. He was adopted by this guy named William Alexander Percy, member of one of the great Southern families, who himself was sort of a poet. He'd gone to Harvard. He'd fought in World War I. And he adopts these three boys. He sends them both to the best schools in the world. I think Walker Percy ends up at some medical school in North Carolina or something. And he gets terrible grades, like his first semester. And he writes home this letter to his uncle, or adopted stepfather, essentially, thinking like, you know, he's going to tear me a new one. He's like, you know, I'm so sorry. I did a bad job. I haven't been paying attention. And I think you guys would like this exchange. The letter survives that his uncle writes back to him. And he says, my whole theory of life is that glory and accomplishment and grades are much less important than character and discovering the life you want to lead. And that struck me as like an exchange that's probably extraordinarily uncommon these days. It was uncommon even with my parents, the idea that, and I know you guys have talked about this, that grades like really don't matter at all. Like, not that they don't matter a little bit, but like they don't matter at all. And yet we drum into young people's heads that their worth is determined by their test scores or their grades instead of their character.
You know, I moved from Seattle to DC in 1984, and I wasn't used to this kind of East Coast preoccupation.
Wait, sorry. I don't know if you guys can hear each other, but you're both talking at the same time.
I don't see Ned. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. So, Bill, why don't you go first? Then we'll do Ned.
So I was saying that when I moved from Seattle to DC in 1984, I was stunned by this, what I consider to be an insane preoccupation with grades and elite schools, given that there didn't, at that time, there didn't seem to be much of a correlation between grades and success in later life, and it seemed to make much difference where you went to college. And just before the pandemic, I was lecturing in Houston about our book, and two things happened. I spoke with some high school students who were on the student government in an elite independent school. And I asked these kids, how many of you want to be happy as adults? And they all kind of sheepishly raised their hand. And this one kid said, and I said, what do people tell you about what it takes to be happy as an adult? And this one kid says, we're told that if we get into a good enough college, everything is set, which couldn't be farther from the truth. If you look at the mental health problems in all the elite colleges, they're off the charts. And also, I was given a lecture at another group. Yeah, and I mentioned an elite school, high school in D.C., and this woman came up to me afterward and said, I'm a psychotherapist at the Menninger Clinic here, mental health clinic here in Houston. We know the school really well because so many of the graduates get into these elite colleges, but they can't handle them emotionally. And so they take a medical leave and they come here for treatment. And what she said is that none of them have the experience of dealing with hard stuff. And they've kind of been driven by this kind of false narrative that the most important thing is your grades and your resume, and not you as a person.
We open by defining this idea of being self-driven. The other word that appears a lot in the books, and Bill, let's go with you first, this idea of agency. I feel like that is a word that not a lot of people understand. They use it incorrectly, but it also, I would say, agency and a lack thereof is actually at the root of a lot of the problems that we have as a society today, either perceived lack of agency or actual lack of agency. But at the core, society depends on agency.
Well, it was so interesting, Ryan, and that, you know, Ned and I lectured a lot initially about motivation and about all the stress-related mental health problems that young people have. And they're just kind of off the charts now, but have been growing for the last 20, 30 years. And every place we looked to try to understand how do people become self-motivated, all the arrows pointed in the direction of that agency or sense of control. And also, when we looked at what makes life stressful, why are kids so stressed, we learned that the four factors that contribute to making life stressful are, you can summarize with the acronym NUTS, and it's novelty, unpredictability, perceived threat, and a low sense of control. And it's that low sense of control, that low sense of agency or autonomy, that is so that is more stressful than anything else. And so Ned and I figured if autonomy or that sense of agency or control is crucial to motivation, to that self-motivation, that healthy internal drive to serve this world in a meaningful way, and it's also completely related to mental health, then it must be a big deal, which is why we wrote The Self-Driven Child, to try to help parents and educators kind of get ideas about how do we help to nurture that sense of agency, that sense of this is your life, and I have confidence and respect that you can figure out your own life.
Well, isn't the irony of agency, and the Stoics talk about this a lot, that the vast majority of life and what happens and what we see is not in our control, that we don't have any agency about it. And yet, the most important thing where we do have agency is, of course, how we respond to all those things.
Right. And we, you know, we mentioned in the introduction to our book, we talk about the serenity prayer, the wisdom of the serenity prayer, you know, that, you know, give me the, as you know well, the serenity to accept what I can't change and the courage to change what I can and the wisdom to know the difference. And that sense of control or sense of doesn't mean that I'm supposed to control everything or I get to control, the kid gets to be the boss of the family. What it means is the opposite of sense of control are feeling helpless or hopeless or overwhelmed or impotent, chronically anxious, chronically stressed, chronically fatigued. And so I think being clear about what we can control and what we can't is crucial. And for parents, the take-home point for our book is you really can't control your kid. You can't make another human being do something against their will.
Yeah, and if you can, if you do force them to do something, it's like building, you know, a castle made of sand. It's not. You can give them the tools, you can give them character, you can give them guidance, but you can't make them do it. And if you do make them do it, you know, as soon as they have the ability to undo it, they're probably going to do it.
That's completely right. That's exactly our experience. And our experience is that you can really from very quite young, you can encourage kids to think about this is your life and nobody knows you better than you know yourself. You're really the expert on you. And so there's a lot of ways that we talk about in the book that we can help nurture this sense that this is my life. And not in a you're on your own buddy kind of way or not in a selfish way, but just acknowledging that we don't know. I didn't always know what was my kid's best interest. And as you have pointed out, that oftentimes what seems like a disaster turns out to be something that in the long run is very important and very useful. And we want kids to have this experience of making decisions and learning from them and seeing that if you flunk a class, your whole life doesn't come tumbling down.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorn sponsored today's episode. Thorn takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorn, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorn. Go to thorn.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorn.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
One of the things that strikes me, though, about where we're going as a culture, like, I think it's wonderful that we're more inclusive, that we're more sensitive, that we understand the sort of forces and pressures and structures that are acting on individuals. It seems like also you can end up out of this compassion depriving someone of agency. So, like, I think about this with, like, trigger warnings. On the one hand, I try to go through the world not offending people, not saying things that are insensitive, trying to consider how my words and actions would be perceived by someone of different experiences or different realities that I know nothing about. And yet, the idea that they don't control how they respond to what other people say and do, or even how messed up or rigged the system might be, seems like it implicitly deprives a person of their agency.
I think that's a really interesting point, Ryan. And you know, we take the term. I take offense at that, and it's an act. I'm choosing to be offended by what you say, and oftentimes we say I didn't mean any offense, but I do think so much. The way people become emotionally strong and resilient. From my point of view, I think from a Stoic point of view as well, you know, it's by experiencing challenges in life and dealing with them, and then developing the confidence that I can handle. I can handle stuff. I can handle and increasing stress tolerance. You know, we talk about, Ned and I talk about stress tolerance probably more than resilience, because what we want kids to be able to do is to function well even in stressful situations and not avoid them. Or not freak out. And so I do think that by trying to protect kids too much, that we really do deprive them of developing that healthy sense of control and that confidence they can handle hard stuff.
So Ned, we were just talking about this idea of agency in kids. I've got to imagine you see kids that come in that don't have any sense of their own agency, any belief that they can change, that they can grow. It's, you know, when Carol Dweck talks about having a growth mindset, it seems like what she's really talking about is, do you believe you have agency over your own mind and your own growth, or do you not?
Oh, that's exactly right. And more often it's of course, it's not a continuum more than being binary as we would all imagine. And so, you know, in the work that I'm always trying to do, it's always trying to help kids feel that their successes are theirs. You know, that I'm, you know, when people say I never could have done it without you, I come up with all the clever ways I can to try to disabuse them of that notion, because it's such an unhealthy one. I mean, my wife, the Latin teacher, who I mentioned before, is so enamored of your Daily Stoic book. She's been using that with her students in school. Maintains that when her mom was driving her across country to deposit her at college where we met, on the way there, her mom, I think in her own anxiety, said to Vanessa, "I don't know how you're going to make it without me."
Yikes.
And she's, I mean, she's a lovely woman, but she's very fretful. And you think, it's hard to come up with words that'd be more disempowering than those, yes. Right? You know, where as we maintain in our book, The Self-Driven Child, that one of the most powerful things you can say to any person, particularly to teenagers, that I have great confidence in your ability to make decisions for yourself. And that when you make mistakes, which you will because you're human, last time I checked, that you'll figure out what the next best thing is to do then. Because what is life but that? If make a decision, some are good, some are bad, okay, learn, adjust, adapt, you know, on and on we go. Because for me, I mean, certainly I also see, as Bill mentioned at the top of this, he tends to work more with kids who are really struggling and trying to find motivation to do the school thing. I tend to work with more often with the kids who are just obsessively driven, perfectionistic. And that's also a terrible, terrible place to be. And with perfectionism, it's really this fear of making mistakes, in part because they've never done them. And I, for years, people would ask, well, you know, you seem to be really good at this work that you do, Ned. You know, why are you any better than anyone else? And I used to make the point, though most people look at me like I'm nuts. I said, well, I simply had the advantage of having more kids fail with me than other people did early on. And I'd sit there and look at them like, well, darn it, what did I miss? What did I get wrong? Wow. And to try to figure it out. But at this point, I really am convinced you can give me almost any situation and almost any kid. And I'm convinced that I can make it better. Will I make it perfect? That's not my goal. My goal is to make it be better. And so for a lot of kids in school, yeah, they don't feel a sense of agency and they're not doing things that really matter to them. And they may not feel that their successes are really their own, that it's, you know, parents or tutors or, you know, whole coterie of other people doing things for them that they can do themselves.
There's a bunch of things there, which I loved. So the first of which is we're talking about agency. We were just saying, like, because I failed, I've learned all these things, which is in a weird way, the ultimate trump card and the ultimate bit of agency that we have, which is from the worst failure, from the most devastating tragedy, from the biggest mistakes that we make, we always have the power to say, I'm going to learn from this. And really, no one can ever take from you the ability to do that. But most people just see the failure and that's sort of the end of it. The other thing that I love, you're talking about the confidence that in the person to make the right decision. I've been reading a lot about Admiral Hyman Rickover, who's sort of the father of the nuclear Navy. And he builds, you know, almost externally in, but inside the Navy builds this sort of whole separate Navy, the nuclear Navy, you know, at the end of the Second World War, at the beginning of the Cold War. And his famous mantra that would be sort of repeated inside his sort of set of proteges is, you know, someone would come to him with a bunch of things and he'd sort of this, and then they go, well, what do I do? And he would say, do what you think is right. Because he wanted that mantra to spread through the organization, which is like, because you can't make people's decisions for you, and you don't want people to be making the decisions that they think you want them to make. You want them to be empowered, and you want to be able to trust them that they will make the right decisions because you've gotten on the same page about what's right, about what's important, about what your shared goals are, so on and so forth. But ultimately, you have to have confidence that your kids or your employees or whomever is going to make the right decision. Because if you don't, I mean, it's a pretty bleak, exhausting future that you've laid out for yourself.
Well put.
I mean, you know, I was reflecting. I have a former colleague who was really talented, very bright, but very controlling. And she seemed really to live her life by the mantra, if you want something done right, do it yourself. And you're thinking, and all I can think is, you aren't going to get that far that yes. way.
That but, doesn't scale.
You know, yeah, what's that? I mean, I think it's apocryphal, but there's some proverb that literally, you know, comes out somewhere in Africa, and I can't recall, but that says simply, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go with others. And to bring in your point there, Ryan, just ideally do it with people whom you trust.
Yes. Yeah. So, how does this work though? Like, let's say, you know, do what you think is right. I trust you to make good decisions. I want you to be self-driven. At the same time, like, how do you have high expectations, have high standards in your family, in your business, in life, and then also be hands-off, right? There's sort of a tension there of like, you expect or want your kid to fulfill their potential, to be great, to be everything they're capable of being. And at the same time, you can't want it for them more than they want it for themselves.
Right. And I'll say that one part of that is simply that we want to inspire our kids, and we can inspire them in part by living the life that is worth emulating, or that we model the things that we want our kids to ascribe to or to follow. And so, I mean, I certainly trying to in terms of expectations, we know that parents' expectations for kids are hugely related to academic achievement, but it's not, you must get good grades, you must go to an elite school. It's, I have confidence that you can do well. It's the expression of confidence in kids that they can figure things out, that they can learn to create a life that they want, while we're modeling a life of integrity and a life of purpose and a life of meaning and self-discipline and the things that we want our kids to learn.
There's another famous Rickover story. I told it on my episode with James Clear, and I'm going to use it in my next book. But Jimmy Carter comes out of the Naval Academy. He wants to work for Hyman Rickover. He wants to make it on a nuclear submarine. And so famously, though, Rickover interviewed every single person that works in the nuclear Navy. And so he has this interview with, and so he sees the best and the best out of the Navy. And he's interviewing Jimmy Carter, who's brilliant and ambitious and hardworking. And, you know, they're going through his resume, what he accomplished, the submarines that he worked on, and Carter's sort of going through his achievements. You know, I was 33rd in my class. I, you know, I accomplished this. I won this, blah, blah, blah. And Rickover looks at him. He listens to all of it. And he goes, but did you always do your best? And Carter sort of stops and he thinks about it. And he knows that he could lie and say, yes, always. And he realizes that's probably not what Rickover wants. And so he goes, you know what? No, I didn't always do my best. And Rickover stands up and says, why not? And then walks out of the room. And that question, like, why didn't you always do your best? Rickover ends up hiring Jimmy Carter. And then obviously we know Jimmy Carter goes on to be president while Rickover is still in his position. So they have this wonderful working relationship. But that question of why didn't you give or do your best becomes sort of the mantra by which Carter lives his life. In fact, his campaign biography, like the book that he publishes, I forget what year he runs for president, but it's titled Why Not the Best? And I love that idea of, like, in that sentence, Rickover imparted an entire life philosophy to Carter, which is like, you should always do your best. That's the highest standard that you can really expect from a person. And in just a few words, he sort of imprinted it on this kid's DNA, which I think is what we have to try to do as parents or educators or whatever, is like, are you, it's not like I expect you to get these grades or do X, Y, and Z. It should be, I expect you to give your best, whatever it is that you're doing and whatever road you decide to walk.
Well, it's, you know, it's interesting. We actually pick up that idea in our second book, you know, because we'll get parents saying, well, I don't care what grade he gets so long as he does his best. And I think it's a powerful idea, but one has to be careful, because for Ryan Holiday to hold himself to his best and for Ned Johnson to hold himself to his best is a different thing than a parent holding a kid to his best. There's this cartoon we love,
sure,
where this little kid looks up to his parents with dad and thinks, "Did I do my best?" You know, and so it's the idea that I was just reading up on Seneca quotes. That was I guess it was Aurelius saying, you know, we love ourselves above other men, and yet we seem to care about their opinions of us more than our opinions of ourselves.
Yes,
and. You know, so when people, you know, this idea of doing my best, and I'm constantly looking outward to say, is that my best? And it just makes me worried, because there's a wonderful body of research by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, maybe three years ago, that was looking at the sources of anxiety and stress in adolescence. And the first three were poverty, trauma, and racism. And the fourth and fifth were intense pressure to excel and social media. And so when you think about this, do you doing your best? If it's really an extrinsic locus of control of other people judging me, was that my best or not? You know, it can lead to some pretty bad things. Whereas I was just in my head for a moment there, Ryan, playing with the idea of what best means. Now, is that like maximum achievement, or is that doing things with the highest amount of integrity? You know, of not holding myself short of saying, you know, that I could have been more thoughtful. I could have taken more care with that, right?
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at Progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Yes. Well, best can't be a euphemism. Doing your best can't be a euphemism for beating other people in competition. Best has to mean, did you do everything you were capable of doing or wanted to do on this? Like, I think about it with books. Like, did I do my best? Is not, did it sell the right amount of copies? Did it get recognized by certain people or win certain awards? It's, did I cheat myself or the book on a random Tuesday when I could have been working on it and should have been working on it, but instead I browsed Twitter all day, you know, or did I pull my punches because I was afraid, or, you know, was I really worried about just impressing a handful of people, or was I actually trying to say something that I really believed in? So I think best has to mean, as you talked about the locus of control, the boundaries of did you do your best is, did you try all out, and that includes integrity and effort and commitment, all those other things, on the things that were up to you.
And I like that little wrinkle that you had in there of to your own satisfaction, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because I know you talk a good deal about moderation and, you know, the idea of enough, right? And so, do I make enough money to have the life that I want to have versus people who are obsessively driven? I need, you know, I made $1 million. Now I need two, you know, yes. And where does that end? In our upcoming book, we have a chapter about talking with kids about the pursuit of happiness. And Bill, if this is your line, you know, phrases that of, are kids building a life or living a life, or any of us living lives that we want? Right. And that to me is the best, that at the end of the day, we can be deeply satisfied with. This is a funny story, and Bill, I'll stop talking in a moment, I swear. But, you know, the point about Churchill and his Brick Lane, right? So yes. I have this, my family has this, we're lucky to have this cabin up in upstate New York. We're right across the lake from Jess Leahy, who I know is a mutual friend. And yes. It's this kind of dissolute property. It used to be a great camp. The whole thing got knocked down, but there's all this hardscape still there. So your listeners can't tell by looking at this, I'm a massive 5'9½" and 158 pounds. So I've been rebuilding a stone wall for almost 20 years with my natural size and strength. And I had this one time when my wife and my kids were, my wife was visiting her in-laws with our kids, and I had literally 14 hours. I could have done whatever I wanted, spend the whole time in the internet, whatever, whatever, whatever. And I sat there and rebuilt this entire length of wall, I don't know, 100 and something linear feet. And at the end of the day, I have never had a greater flow experience than that. I was never more satisfied. I could barely lift my hand to put a glass of water to my lips. Now when I look at it, it's a solid maybe B minus, but at that point, that was the best that I could do. And I was incredibly satisfied and proud of the work that I'd done, even though other people might be like, should have hired a pro.
Yeah, I think Martin Luther King says this. He's like, if you're going to be a shoe shiner, be the best damn shoe shiner in the world, right? Sort of no matter what the task is, you have to give your best. But I think where we go to agency and where I think this is important, and I think it's in your book. I might have gotten it from someone else, but this was helpful for me when I heard about it. It's like, I remember as a kid, it's like, you know, you're taking piano lessons and you don't want to do them anymore. And your parents are concerned. They don't want you to be a quitter. But it's like you never voluntarily decided to play the piano. You were forced into doing this thing. So doing your best on something that you were bullied into or you were doing without agency is not the same as, you know, you committed to writing this book or you committed to starting this company or whatever it is you decided to do. That demands your best. Like, I don't know if you necessarily have to do your best waiting in line at the DMV or, mm-hmm. or something. You know what I mean? Well,
yeah. And Bill has a great story about being forced to play piano or not.
Well, in our book, I mentioned that my parents could tell ours musical. I wanted to play the accordion of all things. They said, well, if you demonstrate you have discipline to practice in the piano, which we own a piano, then we'll buy an accordion. I didn't want to play the piano. I have a really good ear for music. I didn't want to learn to read music. So I took lessons for a couple months, and my parents let me quit. And I say in the book, I've always been grateful to them for letting me quit, because when the Beatles came out, I got in the band. I'm still playing rock and roll band 50 years later, 60 years later. And I play and sing probably more than anybody I know who is forced to practice. And so I think that agency piece is really important. But I also want to mention that I think that there's a balance between always doing your best and accepting if you can't, that being accepting to yourself, that not having that perfectionistic drive that's never good enough.
Yes.
It's that healthy balance between there's a difference between saying, oh, that's good enough, and yeah, this is good enough. This is good enough for me to go on the next thing. And so many of the kids that we work with who have this completely anxious, obsessive, perfectionistic kind of idea where they just lose all sense of proportion. So much is trying to help them is to get comfortable with the idea that good enough doesn't mean, oh, that's good enough, and I'm just doing a half-assed job. It means I put in my, I've done well on this, and I can go on to the next thing.
Yeah, Churchill said that the other way to spell perfection is paralysis, yeah. And I think people get stuck trying to do it perfectly and end up not getting it done, and then they don't get the sort of iterative cycle where you do something over and over and over, where you get the reps and you get better and better because you're still stuck on draft one. As all writers know, like, you got to finish the draft so it can get notes, and then you can edit it, and then you can redo it. But if you never finish, you never get on to version 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Well, one of the interesting things we learned in writing our second book was this: the difference between people who have a healthy drive for excellence. They want to do an excellent job at everything that they do, but it's not perfectionistic. And because they have a sense that when they're done, and the people who have that healthy drive for excellence, they welcome mistakes because they learn from them. Perfectionists avoid mistakes or try to cover them up. And then it's just as you're saying, they don't have a chance to learn from them.
Yeah. And let's go to this idea of sort of how you teach being self-driven. You guys mentioned sort of inspiration or example. That's obviously the essence of Stoicism. Epictetus says, you know, don't talk about your philosophy, embody it. I think one of the popes said, you know, preach all the time, use words when necessary. But in the history of Stoicism, you know, Marcus is adopted by this guy, Antoninus Pius, who's supposed to sort of be the regent who guides Marcus for a year or two before Marcus becomes emperor. But Antoninus ends up living for almost two decades. So Marcus spends two decades under this older man who is everything he wants to be. And when you read Meditations, it's if you haven't looked at it, there, it's an incredible passage where he lists all the things that he learns from Antoninus. Here, actually, Marcus here has a pretty good definition of being self-driven that I think you guys might like. He says, my adopted father, compassion, unwavering adherence to decisions once he'd reached them, indifference to superficial honors, hard work, persistence, listening to anyone who could contribute to the common good, his dogged determination to treat people as they deserved, a sense of when to push and when to back off, his altruism, his searching questions at meetings, a kind of single-mindedness, almost never content with first impressions or breaking off the discussion prematurely, his constancy to friends, never getting fed up with them or playing favorites, self-reliance always and cheerfulness, his constant devotion to the empire's needs, his stewardship of the treasury, his willingness to take responsibility and blame for both, his ability to feel at ease with people and put them at ease without being pushy, his willingness to take adequate care of himself, not a hypochondriac or obsessed with his appearance, his willingness to yield the floor to experts. He respected traditions without needing to constantly congratulate himself. I could go on, but the point is, there's no evidence that Antoninus explicitly taught Marcus any of this. He taught it by actually living the ideas, which I think is the hardest thing for a parent to do, to go, I could give you a lecture about this, but instead I'm just going to show it to you with how I live my own life.
Well, it's such a good point. And part of it is we know that one of the reasons that we as parents and all sorts of other relationships tend to lecture and nag and scold kids is it gives us a sense of control. We feel like it's effective. It may not be effective at all, maybe actually counterproductive, but it makes us feel better because, you know, sitting on our hands and biting our lips and letting kids, you know, make their own mistakes and draw their own lessons from them is really hard to do. The other thing that I would say that we talk in the book about how do kids develop this inner drive, this self-motivation. Bill was looking early on about how do adolescents become self-motivated, and he stumbled on the research of a guy named Reed Larson, who makes the point that adolescents and teens and adolescents don't become self-motivated by dutifully doing their homework. It's by what Larson describes as the passionate pursuit of pastimes. And so this is when they're deeply engaged in really that, you know, Mihai Six and Mihai Flow experience, whether it's, you know, rock climbing or art or music or dance or small engine repair or, you know, learning how to lasso a horse. I mean, things that you have to work at over and over and over to get it right. And then you keep working at it over and over and over to get better and better and better. And so I know that all of us know people who have been profoundly successful in their lives in all the ways that matter to them, some of whom were very academically successful and some of whom were far from that. And so we seem to be living in a time when we feel that we have to get our kids in, they have to be academically successful at every step of the way. They have to go to USC whether they play water polo or not, right? And without that they can't build successful lives. And it's just hogwash. And it also pulls kids away from the activities to which they're naturally drawn, those very same experiences where they would have this inner drive, this flow experience, and wire their brains for intrinsic motivation, knowing that they may, when they're 19 or 23 or 33, all of a sudden have an academic interest that draws them, but they've wired a brain that is ready to work hard at things that matter to them.
Yeah. And how can you expect to have a self-driven child if everything you do in your life, you know, you became a doctor because your mom wanted you to do, and you move, you live in this neighborhood because that's where, you know, people of your background or occupation live, even though you hate it, you know, you're driven by this compulsion or this addiction. Like you can't expect your kids to do or follow advice that you flagrantly violate with your own choices day to day.
Well, one of the main things that we recommend to parents is that, especially as their kids get a little bit older, you know, that they think about themselves more as consultants to their kids, rather than as the kid's manager or boss or the homework police, where the role is ultimately to help kids learn to run their own lives. And we think there's so much mental health problems and so many kids who can't finish their first year of college because they simply don't have enough experience running their own lives while they're at home. And for us, that's the goal. That's the goal, is to kind of model as much as we can that healthy living and encourage kids to find the things in their life that are important to them to work important enough that they work hard to get better and better and better and better, and that they focus on self-development so that they have something useful to offer this world, which we think is the way we want kids to think about motivation, what they're doing is developing themselves so they have something useful to offer this world. And this consultant idea is a nice alternative to thinking that somehow I'm supposed to be the boss of my kid, or I'm supposed to be the kind of manager aspect of my kid's life.
Yeah, it's like you're a facilitator in their drive or path to mastery. What is the profession or task or you know, craft or whatever it is that they're going to become great at? And how do you help them? How do you help them do that? And it may require a bunch of starts and stops. It may be the exact opposite of what you think is valuable or interesting. But your job is to help them become great at something. And it may be that becoming great at this thing, which, you know, there is no future in and makes no money in, is precisely what sets them up to transfer those skills to another thing that doesn't even exist yet.
That's a wonderful point. I was a C-plus student in high school, but I was a passionate rock and roll guy, and I don't remember ever turning in a homework assignment on time. I don't remember ever getting past page 50 in a book. But I play rock and roll and practice my instrument and learn songs and teach myself chord structure 2 or 3 hours a night. And my father died at the very end of my senior year of high school. It kind of woke me up and kind of matured me a bit. So when I hit college, I was a straight A student. Yeah, close to straight A. And I got myself into the top graduate school in English literature. I promptly flunked out of that, which is actually the best thing that could have ever happened to me, because I was much more suited to be a psychologist than an English professor.
And I should add to the tens of thousands of kids whose lives you've transformed by helping them understand how their own brains work.
Thank you, my friend. But I really do feel that you talked about the plasticity of the adolescent brain. I really feel that through rock and roll, I sculpted a brain that once school became important to me, I could go pedal to the metal.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. I wrote something about that many years ago, that everything I know about being a writer, I learned from Iron Maiden. I was a huge heavy metal fan as a kid. And yes, you know, it was writing songs with my friends and recording them with my friends and researching. You go down this rabbit hole, and you might think that it's totally unapplicable to actual real life. But it turns out I was learning about, you know, the artistic business. I was learning about history. I was learning about all these things. And mostly, though, I was learning about what I liked and I didn't like, and how to be self-driven at something. Isn't there a tension, though? As a college dropout, I've written about this before, I often get messages from kids. It's often like 3 a.m, you know, they're asking me for permission to drop out of college, basically. This might be surprising, but I almost always tell them not to, because the vast majority of the kids that I am talking to are not thinking of dropping out of college. They're failing out of college and trying to salvage it by quitting. So one of the things I always talk about is I say, like, it's not that college is important, but if you can't, if you're having trouble playing this game in college and all sort of systems are a game, why do you think you're magically going to be better at life not being out of college? So I guess what I'm saying is, and I think you guys touched on this earlier, which is that you have to figure out how to play this game of school. It's not important, but it is, you know, a sort of a system with rules that you have to figure out. Isn't there kind of a tension between, you know, not actually caring about something, not being super motivated in it, and then it also being a sort of a reality of life or existence and sort of figuring out how to, in a moderated way, be proficient enough at it that, you know, you can graduate high school or college or whatever it is. Like, you do have to figure out how to work within certain systems in life.
Well, I think it's a good point. I mean, you know, one of the angles that we come back to over and over and when we talk to folks is that the vast majority of mental health and is really changing thinking from I have to I want to. And so I think there are a lot of kids who are in college and really struggling because they feel like they have to. And then, you know, the statistics right now on college kids and anxiety and depression are just off the charts. And the problem is when you're super, super stressed, by definition, your brain isn't working very well. The stress response is flaring. The prefrontal cortex that handles problem solving, decision making, planning, you know, putting things in perspective, all of that goes completely haywire and can't think your way out of a, you know, paper box, much less the paper bag, much less the dilemma that you're in. And so, you know, when we tell kids, you don't have to, you know, go to college, you don't have to graduate college to, you know, to have the life that you want, but there may be some good reasons why you want to, then that, you know, if you're having that conversation, it pivots much in the direction that Bill has mentioned before of being a consultant of like, well, let's pro con this. Let's, if you want to do this, but there's some real headwinds to this. What are those headwinds? Are these things that we can tackle? Are these things that you need help with? Are these things that are within your control? And because I think you're right, you know, that people, you know, things are going poorly because the dominant manifestation of anxiety is avoidance. You just want to get the hell away from the thing that is really giving you a hell of a time just because this stinks, this is lousy, and thinking the grass is so much greener over there. But you're right. If they can find ways to persevere and be successful, even with maybe lowered expectations for now, that's an important way. You know, playing the game is another way of saying learning how to navigate life in ways that get you and moves you in the directions of the goals that are important to you.
And I guess that's, you know, a part of agency, mm-hmm. right? The Stoics talk about how every situation has two handles. Which one are you going to choose? Mm-hmm. You can go, this is bullshit. It's meaningless. It doesn't matter. I hate it. I quit. Or you can say, I don't like this, but it's a game and I'm going to figure out how to get just good enough at the game that I can get through it. And then once I am through it, I'm going to focus on whatever it is that I want to do.
I often talk with kids and who to whom the most wonderful thing in the world is simply hanging out with other kids.
Yeah.
And I often say, and often they kind of discount that social giftedness that they have. And I say that this is a real gift. Not everybody can do this, but I want you to know that the careers in which you get to skillfully interact with other people, they all require at least a college degree, many a master's degree, and some a PhD. So I want you to translate, to figure out over time how you can translate this passion for interacting with other people and helping people solve problems to doing enough school so you can do what you want to do. And I haven't, it's completely ineffective just to tell kids repeatedly, you need to do better. And so many of the ways that I motivate kids start out by saying, you don't really need to do better. I mean, you could flunk all your classes now if you decide that was a bad idea. There's other ways you can make up for it. But eventually, I want you to learn how to if this may be important to you, I want you to learn how to do it.
Yeah, that it's about sort of preserving optionality, right? You don't know, like for me, is this, as soon as I knew, okay, what I actually want to do is be a writer, and so the best way to do that is to work for an actual writer, I had a real sort of, I had an off-ramp I could take. But in that intermediate period where you're just sort of dissatisfied or you don't know what you want to do, to sort of drop out or quit or not try and think that you're just magically going to figure it out is probably both naive and makes whatever it is that you want to do later harder. And so, yeah, I think sort of phrasing it as a game or as a strategy, like, hey, does doing this give me more options or fewer options? That's kind of how you want to think about it.
I will. The caveat for me is that Ned and I had an article in the New York Times, I think in 2018 or 19, it came out around Thanksgiving, because by November 1st, we already knew seven kids who had started college and were already home by November 1st. And so they all, to do one, they simply weren't ready to go. And, and our sense is that many kids start college without any signs of readiness at all in terms of being able to run their own life and manage their own sleep and their manage their use of technology. And I think that there are kids who start college, especially kids with ADHD or executive functioning problems, where their prefrontal cortex is 3 to 5 years less mature than it is in most kids. And so those kids start college with a real disadvantage. And there are kids who, taking a year or two, they go back with a more mature frontal cortex and they can do it. But your point is brilliant, that Ned was mentioning that the major manifestation of anxiety, and we don't want to just avoid things. And there may be a timing issue here. This may not be the right time for you to do college, but I don't want you to avoid the things that are hard for you.
Well, the irony, though, is like, let's say, so you're 18 years old, you've been coddled or sheltered by your snowplow helicopter parent, or you've been driven by your tiger mom parent or whatever it is. Then you show up at college, you realize you have no idea how to exist in the world as a human being. You have no idea what you actually want. None of this is important to you. Going back and spending two more years living with those people who are largely to blame for what happened is probably not a boot camp for rapid maturity either.
No, that's not the optimal gap here. You're exactly right.
So how do you? I've got a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. To me, that's my worst nightmare. Like at 18 years old, I was ready to do all those things. I'm self-sufficient and self-driven and had a clear sense of who I wanted to be. I'm not sure how much my parents contributed to that or how much there was some sort of what's that policy that founded America? Was it salutary neglect or benign neglect or whatever? I had some of that. And so how do you, as someone is sort of consciously trying to raise self-sufficient, independent, self-driven kids, what are some big to-dos or not to-dos that we should kind of wrap up with here?
Well, one is don't do for kids that which they can do for themselves, those things they can do for themselves, knowing full well that if your 4-year-old wants to help with the dishes or anything around the house, there's a decent chance that more messes will be made than fixed. But the inclination that kids have, even at a young age, to help, we want to work with that as much as possible. There's a wonderful book out, Michaeline Duclef wrote Hunt, Gather, Parent, and talks about how there are in these other cultures, there's simply an expectation, a culture of having everyone in the family help. And so when you talk about kids being coddled, and not being ready for college, a lot of times that started out maybe well-intentioned enough where parents think, well, my kid's going to goof this up. It's better for me to do this. But then you get on that path and you never get off of it. And part of it also is that parents will often jump in to rescue their kids, partly to rescue their kids, but also because it's so stressful to watch our kids in their own distress. We have our second book is we look a lot about parental over control. And so part of this is, manage your own anxiety first. And as much as you can, Bill has the line of whose problem is it? So if your kid comes home and didn't make the soccer team or didn't get invited to a party or, you know, blew the speech or, you know, is a teacher they don't like or whatever, we have this natural tendency as loving parents to want to protect our kids, including soothing them when things are rough. And we don't want to do that constantly, because fixing things for kids and soothing them rather than letting them, you know, put things in perspective themselves deprives them of the very experiences that wire their brains for stress tolerance and their own motivation.
So it's about letting them do stuff, letting them struggle at said thing. And are there things you should sort of consciously, like if you're like, this is the number one thing that parents with self-driven kids do, like, what do you feel like that thing is?
I think it's treating them respectfully. It's treating them respectfully and realizing that kids want their life to work. You know, everybody, if they can, wants to have a successful life. And I think so. It's treating them with respect. And I think starting from the time they're little, do you want to do it this way or this way? Just respectfully giving them choices. And with preschool age kids, you know, we give them a delimited number of choices. Say, which way do you want to do it? But we respect that individual sense of agency. I mean, preschools have historically always known this, because there's always a free choice time. There's what do you want to do? And I think that it doesn't mean that we don't set limits. It doesn't. We absolutely do. But I think that this consultant idea is that we don't always know what's best, and we want to encourage kids to make decisions. We don't want to tell kids the same thing over and over and over again. We want to offer our advice or offer our help, and as little as possible, trying to force it. We want to minimize the extent to which it feels like we're trying to force kids to do things, because you really can't make somebody, you can't make a kid really do anything. And recognizing that is hugely beneficial as well.
I love that. And last thing is, like, since we opened with this, sort of what does it mean to be self-driven? What strategies do you have for adults to remain self-driven? Or if we're trying to be great examples, how do we maintain our own agency being a self-driven person as we go through life?
I think there's a lot of ways, and certainly, Ned and I are huge fans of meditation, and I think that meditation is one way that allows us to, in our case, twice daily, kind of reconnect with ourselves. And so many ideas during meditation pop into your head about this is important to me. I'd like to do this or that. And so I think that the habits of self-care, of meditation, exercise, challenging the thinking, the practicing of acceptance, accepting the reality as it is, and not thinking that somehow it's supposed to be different or we're supposed to be different. There's so many tools that adults can use, and certainly the Stoic approach, which I've just been learning about, because I've been meditating for 47 years, I've focused more on Eastern philosophy, but I'm just shocked by how much practical wisdom that there is in this tradition.
I love it, Ned. Any last words?
Well, I would add to that you know, when we talk about self-driven, one, it's the subjective sense of autonomy, and two, the brain state that supports it, where when we're in a healthy mental balance, our prefrontal cortex that's really the key, you know, that's all these executive functions, including anything involving goal-directed behavior. So living lives of moderation, of being well-rested, of having downtime to really reflect on what matters to us, and how do we want to spend our time? There's a curious. Obviously, again, my wife, the Latin teacher, we have an inscription from Seneca over our mantle.
I was just going to ask you about this. Yes.
Yeah, and I'll do my best not to butcher, because I'm not the scholar that you are or that my lovely wife is. But to best my recollection, it's ignoranti quem portum petat nullus suis ventus est, which I gather translates pretty much to, for the person ignorant of the port that he seeks, no wind is favorable. So to be part of being self-driven is having the time to reflect that we're not just responding to every email, every text, every fear, every expectation, but we give ourselves downtime to daydream, to mind wander, and to reflect on what kind of life is it that we want to live and want to build. And then with that in mind, we do the things that are important to move us in the direction of those things that matter to us.
I love that. Yeah, the way I've heard that quote rendered is, to the man who knows not which port he sails, no wind is favorable. And it actually ties, I was just thinking about this with my own life. Like, so I did spend 2 years in college, I would have graduated in 3 years. So I almost got through. But because I didn't go into college knowing, hey, I want to be a writer, here's what I want to write about, I feel like so many of the classes I took, you know, I could have studied under this writer or that writer. Like, why did I take all these general ed classes that don't even matter that I've never thought about again? The handful of really cool professors I met who were world-class at, you know, whether it was political science or creative writing or this or that, those are the people that stayed with me. And so, yes, I think when you don't know where you're going or what you want to do, it makes it very hard to make intentional aligned decisions that get you closer to that thing. You just end up doing what everyone else is doing. And to go back to the college admission scandal, the thing that jumped out at me the most was, I think, Felicity Huffman's daughter. She ended up having to go to jail for this. They cheat to have her do well on the SATs. It turns out she wanted to go to Juilliard, where they don't even require the SATs. The whole thing was pointless.
Oh, God.
So you end up just doing what everyone else is doing, and you might win a competition or cheat to win a competition that you don't even need to be participating in.
Somewhere I picture the oracles of Delphi just sort of, you know, snickering at this whole thing, but
know thyself.
Yep.
Well, guys, I love the book. I'm glad we soldiered through our technical difficulties, and appreciate all the work, and it's been very helpful to me personally.
Thanks for having us on. It's great to talk with you.
Thanks so much for listening. If you could leave a review for the podcast, we'd really appreciate it. The reviews make a difference. And of course, every nice review from a nice person helps balance out the crazy people who get triggered and angry anytime we say something they disagree with. So if you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it. And I'll see you next episode. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shay Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shay Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. Us.